Welcome to Real Money Radio, the show that focuses on real people, real problems, and real solutions. Here's your host, certified financial planner, David Holland.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Good to have you with me. Listen, have you ever wondered what people do that seem to keep trying and trying and trying and then they finally succeed? Or what makes it where people try and they can't, or it doesn't work? Or you hear people how they've had some major life event that just rocks their world. They get up, they dust themselves off, and then they've never been stronger. It's a mystery, isn't it? And it is something, though, that is part of the financial world. It's part of, our culture in the United States with our very tuned-in entrepreneurial capitalist society. Our country, you know, right or wrong, people can fail within our country. And we have safety nets in place, of course, but we have a system where people can strive and try and do. And of course, that's what investing is all about as well. So we wanted to take a little turn here, a little different show for you today, but I know you'll enjoy it. We have a special guest, Megan McCurdle, who is a journalist. She is Washington-based. She writes about economics, business, public policy for Bloomberg View, full-time blogger. Her work has appeared in Newsweek, The Economist, The Atlantic, The New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and numerous other outlets. She's appeared regularly on MSNBC, Fox News, and NPR. And her book, The Upside of Down, Why Failing Well is the Key to Success, and that is recently launched, and we're very glad to welcome Megan to the program. Welcome, Megan.
Thanks for having me.
Listen, thank you for taking some time. Okay, so first I got to ask, a full-time blogger, what does that mean your day looks like?
Well, I get up around 6, start looking through the news after I've fed the dog and let him out.
Okay.
And by 9, I give my editor a list of things that I'm planning to write about that day, and then I start writing.
Okay. All right. Well, that's, I know people wonder, what does a blogger do again?
That is what we do.
That's what you do. All right. Well, I see you have your BA in English Literature from University of Pennsylvania and MBA versus Chicago Booth School of Business. So you're just doubled up and loaded for bear, as we would say here in the South. All right. Excellent. Well, I appreciate the work you're doing, and your take on all this is a little different, and I will, of course, do a few times here where I'll play a little devil's advocacy, if you'll indulge me. But I think it's really interesting, your take on this. You kind of got your perspective on this. You worked for a couple of failed startups and then had a short-lived business before starting one of the first economic blogs while you're working for a disaster recovery firm at Ground Zero. So give us a little bit of that background and what prompted you to write this book and why it's so important for people to really embrace or look to learn and leverage these things that have happened that maybe might otherwise be looked at as just negative.
Well, people ask a lot, why did you decide to write a book about failure? And the answer I always give is write what you know. I went through some very hard times in my life of being not exactly unemployed, but of being underemployed and trying to figure out what I was going to do with the rest of my life for a couple of years after grad school. Bad breakups, the things that affect most people's lives from time to time. And what I realized later, much later, was that those things had really set the stage for the success that came after them. For example, The Economist, I graduated from business school with $100,000 worth of student loans, like a lot of MBAs.
Okay.
And that was okay because I had a six-figure job lined up when I came out. But then the 2001 recession happened, and I ended up making, when I finally got a job 2 years later, $40,000 a year working for The Economist.
Okay.
And
okay.
So obviously,
that's a big adjustment.
That was a big financial hurdle. And what I realized later was that if I hadn't had that 2 years of working at Ground Zero, trying to figure out, find a new job, and I was the master of almost getting jobs. I almost got like every job in the city and state of New York.
Okay.
And then something would happen. There'd be a hiring freeze, or I got in the Foreign Service, and then I didn't flunk the physical. And so that process was actually what enabled me to take the job at The Economist. Because if it hadn't been for that, right, the financial risk would have been too great. Despite the fact that I decided I wanted to be a writer when I was 8. And I gave that up to be safe, to pursue things that seem more reasonable.
I'm with you now. Okay.
Sensible.
Okay.
And what it turns out is that doing something you're really good at and that you love is a much better recipe for success than doing the safe thing that everyone told you was a good idea.
Amen to that. And that's where that life experience or that failure then you say, okay, well, golly, that's where you then, it's almost like you get like a reality check, and then there's that opportunity to pursue what you're really passionate about.
Well, exactly. And here's the thing is that failure feels bad. I did not want to, you see books on failure sometimes, and people will get overly cheery about it, like, oh, this is the best thing that ever happened to you. And it can be. I mean, one of the things I talk about in the book is the shocking number of people who describe shocking events as the best thing that ever happened to them. Like,
that is a surprise.
Going to prison, yeah, or getting divorced, being left at the altar. But it doesn't mean it feels good at the time. And in a way, it has to not feel good at the time.
Good point.
You know, failure is nature's way of telling us, stop, that doesn't work, don't do it anymore. That if it felt good, we wouldn't do it. It's the feeling bad part that actually stimulates us to change and grow.
Yeah, it's a good swift kick, you know where, to get you on.
Everyone needs one occasionally.
Yes, we do. Yes, we do. Well, it's a very different take. I applaud your work, Megan. I think it's really interesting because it is, you know, there's a lot of different psychology going on here, and there's also, it's wrapped up in our culture, and I'm going to grab a break. When I come back, Megan, I really like to talk to you. We go so many places with this discussion, but I think it's interesting to understand how we're different here in the United States than perhaps, and how this works here, and how failure works here, and where it results versus maybe around the world. So
yes, this is really important, and yeah, it's really one of our greatest strengths.
Excellent. Well, hold right there. We'll come right back. Megan McArdle, journalist, the book, The Upside of Down, Why Failing Well is the Key to Success. MeganMcArdle.com, McArdle.com. Quick break. We'll be right back.
Retirement planning doesn't have to be hard, complicated, or stressful. It also doesn't have to be in a hurry or with sales pressure. Since starting Holland Financial in 1997, it has been David Holland's mission to help individuals and couples plan their futures with personalized financial planning. David puts himself in his clients' shoes and recommends products and services he would choose for himself or his family. To learn more about Holland Financial or to schedule a one-on-one consultation with David, call 671-PLAN or visit planstronger.com.
And we're back with Megan McArdle, our guest today. Super, super journalist. Very unique perspective you had, Megan, and I appreciate it. And you've written about it, of course, in your book, The Upside of Down, Why Failing Well is the Key to Success. Now, I have to get some perspective because I find it very interesting, and I know you write about this a lot. Why is the United States, or how is the United States different in regard to how people are allowed to fail, how they're able to pursue their dreams, our capitalist society, and why that is maybe different than, say, for example, Europe or Russia, where, you know, they're trying capitalism there and it doesn't seem to be working?
You know, this is a really important thing because people tend to think of the United States as the place that's mean to people who failed, and, you know, big European social democracies as the place that's nice to people who failed. And that's not really accurate. What we do is we treat failure differently from other countries. And in many ways, we're actually quite a lot kinder to failure than a place like Europe is. So one of the ways that you see this difference is in our bankruptcy laws. It's not really well known, but America has pretty much the most generous bankruptcy laws in the world. Chapter 7, for example, where you just walk in and you say, look, I don't have the money to pay. Here's what I have in the bank, my $300, and the judge divides up whatever you have among your creditors, and you walk away having cleared all of those debts. This doesn't exist anywhere else. It's only an American invention. Mm. It grew out of our kind of unique history of having a lot of small landowners in the West who owed a lot of money to bankers back East, and when we got a bankruptcy code in 1898, those sorts of provisions were put in. So what does that mean? It turns out it means a lot. So we have a really interesting situation in America, which is that we have a sort of natural experiment. Basically, the bankruptcy code is federal, but the exemptions from the bankruptcy code, how much you can shield from your creditors, that's set by the state, and it ranges from incredibly miserly, like you can only shield a couple $1,000s worth of home equity, to incredibly generous. So in Florida and Texas, no matter how much your house is worth, creditors can't touch it as long as it's your primary residence.
That's right.
And when we look at the differences between states, what we see is that a more generous rate of bankruptcy exemption, especially for houses, is associated with a higher rate of entrepreneurship. And that actually makes sense if you think about it. First of all, because obviously it's easier to start a business if you're not worried that your kids aren't going to have anywhere to live when you're done. But second of all, because, you know, we tend to think of people who failed did it wrong, and people and aren't as smart and competent as people who succeeded. But when you look at serial entrepreneurs, you look at people who've done this more than once, the fact is that most people fail. You know, having started a successful business before, you do have a better chance of doing it again, but you still have like a 2 out of 3 chance of failing.
Right.
And that's because, you know, the market, you can't predict it. If you could predict it, someone would already be doing it. If it were that
that's
obvious.
Right. That's right.
Someone would already have done this idea. What entrepreneurs do is they look for a new space, something that people aren't doing. And the only way to find out whether people actually like it is to try it.
Yep.
You know, and so what happens is most serial entrepreneurs fail. Like the guy who founded Atari also founded Chuck E. Cheese and then founded a bunch of stuff that you've never heard of because it all went out of business.
Right.
He's a very good entrepreneur, but that doesn't mean that it's a sure thing. And so what the bankruptcy exemption does is it lets people who tried once and didn't succeed start over and try again. And those people we know from the data have a slightly better chance of succeeding the second time around than people who've never done it at all.
Interesting.
They take those lessons and they take them in a new enterprise, and instead of losing that information, losing all the valuable experience they've gained, we put it back to work. In Europe, on the other hand, bankruptcy is very hard to get. So in my book, I interview a Danish entrepreneur.
Oh, really?
Who
okay.
has basically been struggling under debt from a business setback from more than 10 years ago now.
Mm.
And that guy is not going out and creating new value and doing new things because he's still laboring under that debt load.
Wow. They never escape it, is what I'm hearing.
Exactly.
Wow.
And it's more than just bankruptcy. I mean, the institutions reflect the culture, which is that in America, if you have been at the helm of a failed company or in the C-suite, that's often viewed as a plus. You know, you've been there and you've done it.
Right.
You've been in the trenches. Whereas people in Europe who have done that find it very hard to get another job after they leave because people think, oh, well, you must be stupid and you don't know how to run a company.
Mm. Well, now let's juxtapose that for Europe. It's quite a bit different in Russia, right?
Well, Russia is a
whole other ball of wax, huh?
Yeah, it's a third situation where, you know, I think that we made a big mistake when we tried to help Russia transition from communism to capitalism.
Mm.
And that is that there was an assumption among economists and right-leaning people generally that markets are natural and that they are what you have instead of government. So if you take the heavy hand of the government away, like, wow, now you're going to have markets. And it turns out that capitalism has a lot of what I think of as soft infrastructure. It's kind of like the software on your computer, which is that the hardware is the stuff like the laws, the institutions, the physical infrastructure. The software are the values and the norms that people have that allow you to go online and just say, I'm going to give money to this random person I've never met on the internet, and he's going to send me goods, and I know I'm pretty confident that he'll do it. And like some people sometimes get cheated, but in America in general, people don't cheat. We tend to think that they don't cheat because they're afraid of the law. But recourse to the law is really expensive. So if as has happened to me and other people, if a hotel gives away your room, because you're late and they think they can sell it to someone else.
Mm-hmm.
I could sue, but am I going
right,
to, it would cost
right.
me so much more to sue the hotel over $100. The reason they don't do it is, first of all, reputation.
Yep.
But even more than that, because it's wrong.
Right.
Because we all agree
right.
that it's wrong, and because doing that, they would be embarrassed to do it. Most of actually what keeps us from doing wrong things is neither the law nor the fear that you'll get a bad reputation. It's just the fact that we're really uncomfortable deliberately cheating people to their face. And so there's a great experiment where they sent people into the subway. See how powerful this sort of thing is. They sent people into the subway and asked them to get up and to ask people to get up and give them their seats. And if the people asked why, they were supposed to say, because I want your seat.
Oh, wow.
And the great part was, first of all, they had trouble getting students to actually go do it.
Oh, that's interesting.
And second of all, most people gave up their seats because the norms that operate, you know, social conventions, when someone asks you for a seat, you figure they must have a good reason and you give it to them. That kind of thing is powerful. In Russia, it didn't exist. It had been destroyed by 70 years of communism. And so there's a story told by an economist of booking a hotel for a big conference they were giving and getting there and the guy had just given away the rooms to someone who paid more. And he was like, you can't do that. You sold me the rooms. And he said, so sue me. That's what happens when you have the law, but you don't have the social norms No one in America would ever do that. It would be too, you know, forget the law, forget reputation. It would be too socially painful
right.
to do that. You would be too ashamed of yourself to do that. When you don't have that, when you don't have all of those norms and the morals and the, you know, the traditions and culture that support capitalism, what you get is what you have in Russia, which is rampant kleptocracy. You know, the rule of law is not supported. The rule of law does not come from the law, and it doesn't come from the government. It comes from the people and what they will tolerate. Good capitalist culture does not come from the law. You need the law. I'm not saying we don't. But it comes from the people and what laws they want and what laws they will enforce on other people by becoming outraged if people violate them.
So the real travesty and long-lasting effect from what Russia experienced with communism is that it, for lack of a better word, bankrupted them on all these social norms or the things that we would do here in America that we take for granted every day. You know, for example, I got a shirt back from the dry cleaners. It's a brand new shirt. It's got a big black grease mark on the collar. I have zero doubt that I'm going to return it to them and say, look, this was a brand new shirt. I have zero doubt they're going to make it right.
Right, exactly. And that is, I think bankruptcy, they bankrupted their cultural capital. They spent it down. And now they don't have it. And you can actually see that the countries that are doing best are the countries that spent the least time under communism.
Mm.
That is how corrosive it was to the norms that you need to run a capitalist society.
Well, this might
and
be
this inflects how we think about failure and risk.
Yeah.
How we treat people who failed.
Exactly. And it might be getting a little outside the topic, but I'm curious. Do you think, ready? You know, my next question is going to be, do you think there's any hope for Russia? I mean, do you think they can... Can they turn that around? We're talking about generations.
You know, I write a lot about this in my daily work about other stuff, transparency and so forth. And I think that there's two answers to that. I mean, the first is like, look, China is managing to run a fairly capitalist society under a pretty repressive communist regime. So.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, on the other hand, you know, obviously I don't support any of their limitations on liberty and
right.
so forth. But they are managing to develop kind of bourgeois commercial norms.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing is that actually there's a story I reported, on Iraq and the climate there, and Iraq has terrible corruption. It's what actually one of the economists I interviewed called entrepreneurial corruption, which is that the actual problem is that at least under Saddam, there was one person you had to pay off. And now agencies are in competition to get paid off, different government bureaucracies, and they create rules for the purposes of generating revenue, bribe revenue. So you make it harder to comply with the law, and then at the point at which it's impossible, someone has to pay you.
Right.
And so I was really depressed, and I called an expert on transparency, and I said, is there any way out of this? And he said, look, he's Latin American. He said, look, Latin American countries used to have this problem, which was that they would also, well, you know, the Norte Americanos, they can do it, but that's not us. We're different. And then Chile basically managed to run a non-corrupt regime. And they sort of started to say, oh, well, I guess it's not actually possible for South Americans to have a relatively clean government. I mean, I say relatively not because Chile's bad, but because... You know, no country is perfect. There's corruption everywhere, but they have a very clean government, especially given the history of exploitative development in South America, and also people returning from the U.S. started saying, "Look, I shouldn't have to bribe a cop every time I get stopped for speeding.
Right?
I don't want to live that way. You
right.
can't just pull me over for nothing and then make me pay you a bribe."
Right.
And so they're starting to demand it. And the third thing is that the transparency. Rankings themselves, you know, he said he talked to a mayor in Mexico who said his goal was they were going to be in the top 10 of this survey of Mexican cities on corruption. And that sort of thing of knowing it can be done, of building, of bringing some of the cultural capital in from people who've lived abroad to expect it and enforce it. But third of all, of having a way of measuring it, they do make improvements. It is turning around.
Okay.
I've talked
so there's
to
hope.
Other people who say the same thing.
There's hope. That's good.
Yes.
All right. Megan McArdle, ladies and gentlemen, journalist, and lots of things to talk about. Very insightful, very interesting. The book, of course, The Upside of Down, Why Failing Well is the key to success. Megan's website, meganmccardle.com. Quick break, we'll be right back.
These are challenging times for investors. The stock market is volatile, with 10% drops a common historical occurrence. Is your portfolio prepared for such a correction? How about inflation? What's your plan for when a gallon of gas or gallon of milk costs $16? And what about interest rates? Did you know that a 10-year bond could drop 10% if interest rates rose just 1%? What's your plan for that? Holland Financial has answers to questions just like these and practical steps you can take to help mitigate these negative events. Call 671-PLAN or visit planstronger.com to schedule your one-on-one meeting with David Holland. Do you have financial questions you'd like answered on this show? Send them to questions@planstronger.com. You will remain anonymous.
And we are back. Megan McCardle is our guest. And lots of good stuff, Megan. I really enjoy it. I have a couple other quick questions I want to get to. I know that in your book, The Upside of Down, Why Failing Well is the Key to Success. In your book, you talk a lot. There's a lot of psychology to what people do with failure. And I know that this is another thing that you've talked about. And this was a little contest that was done, which was kindergartners were building a tower and they're competing with engineers. And I'll steal the thunder. The kindergartners won?
Yes. So this is a great experiment. It's not a contest.
Okay.
I shouldn't say. Basically, a guy who was at the time the head of user experience for Palm, which made, you know, some of the first handheld devices for the younger people in the audience.
Yeah, I remember those.
I had one. I think I had two way back in the day. But so he went out and he did this really interesting experiment. He gave he gave groups of people 25 strands of spaghetti and some tape and said, I want you to build me the tallest structure that's capable of supporting a marshmallow. And some of the groups that did well were what you'd expect. Like Singaporean engineers do very well in this. Some of the groups who didn't do well, so MBAs, I have to say, came in dead last. Apparently, they spent all of their time arguing about like who was going to be the CEO of Spaghetti Inc.
Oh, that's funny.
Rather than building their tower.
That's funny.
But the group that did best, and you know, I saw him do this presentation. He flashes up on the screen, and everyone starts laughing because it's a bunch of gap-toothed kindergartners. And what he said was, the thing about kindergartners is that because very few people understand the structural properties of spaghetti, there's not actually that much advantage to having a lot of training. And so what the kindergartners did was, first of all, they didn't know there were any rules because they're five. So they were the only group that asked for more spaghetti.
Oh, that's hysterical.
To go back to some of those
most basic
cultural
things.
Norms we talked about, right? You know, someone gave you 25 strands of spaghetti. Obviously, that's how much spaghetti you have. Kindergartners didn't know that, so they got more spaghetti. But it's what they did with it that's actually really powerful, which is that instead of like sitting down and trying to design it, because again, they're five, they just started building stuff. And they would try something, and if it didn't work, they'd try something else. And they would, you know, does this make it better? No, take it off and start over. And with that, I mean, so the things that the Singaporean engineers built are like look like the Eiffel Tower.
Yeah.
And the things that the kindergartners build look like some sort of terrifying modern art installation.
Oh, that's fun.
But they worked for their purpose.
Right.
And that's what, you know, that's failure is so powerful, as he says, that if you want to succeed fast, you have to fail fast. Iteration and experimentation is the most powerful force in the universe. It is what drives all of evolution. It is what drives markets. It is what drives every new process of discovering new ways to do things and adapting to changes in the system. Is just change it a little bit, see if it works. If it doesn't, get rid of it and start over.
Well, and also there could be something different than the first time the business was launched. Maybe the timing was, it was a great idea, great, everything was wonderful about it, but the timing was off. It, you know, the market wasn't ready for it, so to speak, or it wasn't something that really fit at the time, but then maybe later it could. I mean, there's so many different dynamics that play into it that, and that experience of having gone through that failure, you know, the next go round, the business person, say, okay, I know the 55 things I'm not going to do this time, right?
Yeah, there's a great Thomas Edison story, which may be apocryphal, but I'll tell it anyway because it's a great story. At some, you know, he's working on trying to develop a light bulb, and he's gone through so many filaments, and none of them are burning long enough or bright enough or won't burn at all. And so a reporter says to him, you know, Mr. Edison, how does it feel to have failed? And he says, what do you mean failed? I know 10,000 things that don't make a good light bulb filament.
Exactly.
Which actually, it's really true. That's, you know, that's all valuable information. I think the best company at this, or one, there's so many good companies at this, but, you know, one of the best companies at this certainly is Apple, one of the best stories. Is you look at, for example, the difference between the Newton and the iPhone. You know, I want a computer I can hold in my hand. And Steve Jobs wanted that in 1990, and he wanted it again in the 2000s. But it was the second time. And it wasn't actually just the lessons of the Newton that they learned from, although they did. They also learned from the lessons that Steve Jobs had gotten when he went away, and he spent some time in the wilderness. And he actually, one of the interesting things that Jobs had to learn was to be less of a perfectionist. So he goes and he founds a new computer company after the board kicks him out at Apple. And he fiddles with this computer so long that it's never ready, right? It takes much longer than it should to come out. And, of course, every time as computing power is advancing, you have to go back and, oh, well,
right,
you know. So that process taught him, look, it has to be really, really good. And I think, and he still was an absolute perfectionist, you know, with one of the iPhone generations. I don't know if it was the first one. I think it might have been. Anyway, the engineers handed to him, and it's like the day before their big
big reveal.
Where they launch all these new products.
Yeah.
And he says, I don't like this headphone jack. When I put the headphones in, it doesn't click.
Oh, boy.
I want it to click. And so the engineers have to go back and strip it all down and make it click, because he felt that was important so that people would know that the headphone jack was seated. It's this, I mean, tiny fixation on detail, but he also realized that there had to be a stopping point, which he hadn't before. That was, you know, he let all of his worst instincts go, and then he learned to rein them in. And those are the lessons that ultimately gave us the iPhone. And, you know, I have one sitting right next to me right now.
Sure.
And there are a lot of companies that are good at this, but Apple was one of the best.
Well, we'll see if they're good and what they will learn from their investigations of the car, right?
Well, I think that this is the real interesting question: is what is Apple without Steve Jobs? And I don't think we quite know the answer yet. They're still going to be finding their way for a while, because they've been, you know, he put so many programs in place, but do they end up with the watch? Do they end up driving further, you know, even the next generation of technology, or does someone else step in to fill that role?
Well, we will see. We will see, Megan, because there will be companies that have tried and failed. And as you've written very well in your book, that there's all these stories and how people get up and they continue to persevere. And I think it's an inspiring lesson. I think it's a great read. The book, The Upside of Down, Why Failing Well is the Key to Success. Of course, the author, Megan McArdle, has been our guest. And her website's meganmcardle.com, MCARDLE.com for McArdle. Megan, you're welcome back. I enjoyed our conversation, and it's been a treat.
I did too. Thanks so much for having me.
You're very welcome. Thank you so much.
Today's edition of Real Money Radio has been brought to you by Holland Financial, conveniently located on Granada Boulevard in Ormond Beach. Could you benefit from a one-on-one confidential conversation with David Holland, or would you like a second opinion to make sure that you're on the right track? Call Holland Financial at 671-PLAN or visit us at planstronger.com to schedule your no-obligation consultation. David looks forward to discussing the financial issues that matter most to you. The host of Real Money Radio, David Holland, is a certified financial planner with over 20 years of experience. And because David provides advice to clients on a daily basis, his hyperactive compliance department wants us to tell you that David Holland is an investment advisor representative of Holland Advisory Services, a registered investment advisory firm. He offers insurance and annuity products through Holland Insurance Services. Commentary given during this radio program should not be considered investment, insurance, tax, or legal advice. Views expressed concerning specific securities are not an offer to buy or sell. Investment advice and planning services can only be given after an analysis of an individual situation and only where Holland Advisory Services is registered or exempt from registering. Real Money Radio is produced by Holland Productions.